You were listening to the Never Meet Your Heroes podcast, conversations with artists about their work and inspiration. I am your host, Anthony Moses Sanchez. On this episode, I met with Professor Cunningham for 2 hours. This is episode 8. Thank you for being on another episode of Never Meet Your Heroes. Today I have Professor Karen Cunningham at UCLA, who's been so gracious to give me some of her time here on campus. Full disclosure, I've had several classes with her, so I am a fan. I wanted to start with, do a different introduction because you have such an illustrious career and wanted to respect that. And I went over your CV, and so I pulled out some questions based upon it to kind of get us, through your life. Why don't we go ahead and start with telling me about some of your childhood, you're a literature professor, some of your favorite books, and kind of how you started into that.
First of all, I want to thank you for inviting me to do this, Anthony, because it's fun, and we have had fun chatting now before we started, so I look forward to continuing that. So I was reflecting on books because I can't remember a time when I didn't read, and I know I got that from my mom and dad. Not that they always had books in front of them, but they always had a magazine or something like that. And I'm of an age and an era where even though we had a television in the house, and we used it and enjoyed it, there was also a lot of time spent reading. So what I loved the most reading when I was younger was anything that had to do with horses. I was raised in Southern California. One of my cousins lives now in South Africa and is herself a horse whisperer and has been for many years. And I think it's just, for me, the romance of the Wild West and seeing horses running across that open land, probably in TV shows, but also reading about them. So there was a series of books, and I don't remember the author, but I think I need to look up these books, about people who drove sulkies in races. So they were horse racing books. And it was fun to think back on that at this current moment and to say, that still sounds like fun. I still think it would be fun to race horses in a sulky, because the sulky, you know what that is, the apparatus that's, it's actually like goes behind the horse. You sit down behind the horse, right? Uh-huh. So it's like a cart behind the horse, but very flexible. That's what sulkies are. So that's a famous form of horse racing.
Okay.
So, and I noticed, and this is, I got this idea from a book called West of Everything, which one of my favorite more recent books, really analyzing Westerns, of which I am very fond. But it never occurred to me that every protagonist in the books that I loved was male. It never occurred to me that I couldn't be a sulky driver because I was not male. None of those things occurred to me at all. And I think that was kind of useful because there was a kind of innocence to that where we didn't notice. And there was a downside to that that maybe we'll end up talking about today or we won't. But there was an upside to it in the fact that I never felt debarred from pursuing things I wanted to do. So the funny thing about this is that many years later, when I was an adult living in San Francisco, I took horseback riding lessons in Golden Gate Park.
Oh, that must have been fun. It's a beautiful place. I've been there several times. Yeah,
it is a beautiful place. And the horseback riding teacher was a man named Bert Winnie, as in horses that whinny.
Oh.
And I couldn't believe it. And I was like, okay, it's not only that I love puns in literature, I'm living in a pun. But those were pretty much my favorite books, was things about horses.
Okay.
When I was younger.
And I like that you bring up that, you know, when you read a book that you don't necessarily see, you see yourself. I mean, for me, when I read books, we can't speak for everybody, but it's like the ideas, whoever's thinking, I'm thinking along them. I'm in their head, kind of like, I don't know if you've seen the film by Michel Gondry, Being John Malkovich, but it does that, like you're kind of behind someone's eyeball. So you're not thinking, okay, yeah, it says a he, but right now it's me. You know, right now I'm the person who, you know, depending on the novel, I'm experiencing that. So I love that. So what other maybe books have you read throughout your lifetime? I mean, your focus is literature, and we won't pigeonhole you into that the whole conversation. But I ask this question because I myself read certain books over again, and I'm like, oh, I missed that. So that's why I figured you might have a similar experience. What books have you read throughout your lifetime that continue to speak to you?
Okay, so this is guilty pleasure time because something happened once I became a professional in literary work. So professionally, as you know, I work on Shakespeare predominantly, and then secondarily a little Chaucer, a little Milton, but especially Shakespeare. So in my free time, what I have always tended to read and still tend to read is drawn entirely from popular culture. It has nothing to do with bestseller book lists or what the New York Times recommends or how the New Yorker evaluates it. It has to do with what I love. So when I was younger, after the horse stage was my Nancy Drew stage.
Oh.
And I loved those. And the fun of detecting was just really captured my imagination. And I'm no good at it. And I think that's part of why I love that aspect of it in books. And probably it did matter that she was a girl, although I'm not sure. You know, I'm really not sure about that. Because as you said, I just tended to be able to enjoy sort of being in the position with almost anybody in a book. And I still do when I look at something. But my Nancy Drew stage seems to have pointed me also to what I read now in my free time, which is almost entirely detective fiction.
Oh.
That's what I'll read. So I'll read female authors, and that was deliberate. I wanted to kind of look at how women authors might handle detective genres. Mm-hmm. And I liked the idea of women protagonists, but then I also read a fair share of male authors, male protagonists, etc. So among my favorites, one of my favorites is Michael Connelly, who writes Hieronymus Bosch, and just the fact that he's named that makes me happy because he has, you know, the allusion to the artist in there, but someone who's a hardcore detective. And one of the things I like about the character is he's really, really good at what he does. But he also loves jazz and knows great jazz. And I know a little about jazz, but my husband is a jazz fiend. And so the novels always, you know, capitalize on that. One of the other things I love about the Michael Connelly books is that they're set in Southern California. They're set in Los Angeles. In fact, he has a great house up on a canyon, which I'm jealous of. And it's damaged in one of the books. So I was like, yeah, but that's okay. He'll just rebuild it up in a canyon with a view of everything.
Yeah.
So I remain insanely jealous of his house. But it's fun reading someone who is looking at my territory through eyes that I find interesting, but that are clearly not my eyes.
Right.
And that's, I think, a lot of the draw. So I've read all the Michael Connelly books, the Bosch books that are set here, and a couple others that he does. But I also read Sue Grafton, who does I'm going to mix up the names. I think she does the ABCD books, like A is for Alibi and B is for this and whatever. And now I think she's up to W or X or Y. I know.
She's running out of letters.
She's running out. She's got the alphabet, you know, and that's a female protagonist. Uh-huh. All of these, I have to say, are set in Southern California.
Okay.
My affection for Southern California is profound, and certainly colored by nostalgia and sentiment, a lot of sentimentality for it, because the Southern California I see when I read these is linked more closely to the one that existed when I was younger.
Okay.
And I love that California. So I feel actually privileged to be able to carry that California with me, but also having writers in the modern day adding their look at that Southern California. Mm-hmm. So, but that's, I tend to read detective fiction.
Okay. And you gave us some great recommendations. I'll have to take a look at some of those. So you say, you know, Southern California has had a profound effect. So I feel like I want to follow up on that. Maybe you can kind of catch us up with some of your life that brought you down here to Southern California, or maybe even begin with what has been the most profound thing about Southern California for you?
That's a great question. What's been the most profound thing about Southern California? I think I'm answering this completely spontaneously, but I do think from my perspective now in life that the most profound thing for me has been the way it's just a mixed up mess. And I think that's probably been a really inspiring thing for me, and probably something that helped me become oddly more confident in a world that is full of things that don't seem to fit together. People who don't look alike, people who don't sound alike, a geography that includes oceans and mountains that you can ski on, and then these whacked out deserts where there are plants that will grow once a year and once a year only, and if you're not there the day the flower gets there, tough on you. Mm-hmm. You should have been there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and a sea made out of salt, you know, and perfectly clear lakes up in Tahoe, and had the gold country, and, you know, miraculously has a Los Angeles or a San Francisco somehow. So I think the fact that to an outsider and even an insider, Southern California might not make sense and might look a little too hard. Mm-hmm. Certainly in the present moment, it's unreasonably difficult for lots of people. I hope that passes. I think for me, those have been parts of helping me grow and have a life that challenged me to grow. Mm-hmm. How I got here is a funny, totally different story, but I love that question. I would think about that question more. I'm actually born in Rhode Island, so I'm officially a Yankee. Which I wouldn't have known if I hadn't lived 10 years in the South and I didn't order grits once and someone said, "What are you, a Yankee?" And I said, "Oh, I guess I am." So, but when I was not yet 2 years old, my family moved to Southern California. My dad was what's called a city manager. And the modern formulation of this is similar to what it was even those decades back. But this was really the first generation of city manager government, where you would have a mayor and a city council and a city manager. And the city managers were largely people who helped oversee that budget. So very aware of those things, something, a quality that I didn't always appreciate, but grew to. But we moved out here. My mom was one of eight kids, and one of her sisters had come out. And so, you know, then she wanted my mom to come. So my mom and dad and my brother, my older brother and I were just children, and we all moved. And we lived at that time in Toluca Lake, sharing a house. And then some more of my brothers and sisters came out, and we lived in North Hollywood. And then some more came out. But then with my family, we moved to Whittier. And then after the Whittier job, we moved to Placentia. And then after the Placentia job, we moved to Rialto. So I think that accounts for most of my official residences in Southern California as a child, mostly associated with my dad's work. It was interesting to me at one point when people said, why have you lived so many places? Are you an army brat?
Mm.
And assumed that, and I didn't realize military people moved every several years. So that was a moment of, you know, learning for me, but they didn't realize city managers did either. So like kind of interesting trade. But during those years, most of my mom's brothers and sisters moved here, and my aunt was married to someone who was a doctor to the stars, and so they had horses and big property and their own petting zoos, and I, you know, that was a part of my early horsiness too. I have, yes, ridden bareback in the Sepulveda Dam when it wasn't even there.
Wow.
No, it was barely there, you know, so... So I think, you know, I think that affection of that I was expressing earlier comes from just the chance to be a kid here was pretty remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
And that was also in the days, I will say, when parents might not have been so protective and would just say, go ride the horses.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you came back a few hours later, that was good.
Yeah.
Kind of thing. So, but then after Rialto, my dad's next job moved us out of California all the way to Astoria, Oregon, which is the end of the Lewis and Clark Trail, which is also, as a very famous slogan for the radio station said, where the mighty Columbia meets the vast Pacific. So it's the end of the Columbia River at the ocean. And it's a beautiful place with hills and having the chance in the house we lived on, which was up on one of the hills, to kind of look down at the river and watch massive ships go in and out up the... They were going up the Columbia River to Portland, come back down and go back and forth. This is where I also learned what a fish cannery really is, because the main industry was fishing, and there were many, many canneries, bumblebee, tuna, all those things. And also trucks of what fish actually looked like by the truckload when they had just come out of the water that day. So massive, as I said, tuna and swordfish and sturgeon and pretty much everything driving down the streets in trucks. So I do also know what a cannery town smells like, I have to say, which is, like, not surprisingly, fish.
Yeah.
So, but after that, my dad's next job was in North Sacramento. And I was we moved there, and I was just getting to the age, for me, I was just getting to college age. So I started college at Sacramento State, which is where I did my undergraduate work. And during my first year as a freshman, I was still a teenager, so my folks, my dad got a different job about an hour away and in Yuba City, and I wasn't going to move because I was going to stay in college. So it worked out great because I got to get my own apartment. Yay! So I didn't have to go to a dorm. I didn't have to do any of that. I went straight from their house into my own apartment. Although the first apartment that I had, because my mom went with me to look for it, and she was very concerned about my safety. You know, the first one we looked at was like a prison with these tiny, tiny windows way, way up at the top, and, you know, extra bars here and all that. And that is not where I ended up living. It wouldn't have worked. But I did my undergraduate work at Sacramento State.
Okay.
So I stayed there as an English major, and... one of the things that happened is I was just so in love with theater, with plays by especially Shakespeare at that time, and I couldn't decide. I really was having trouble deciding whether I wanted to be an English major or a theater major, and so I basically did both. That worked out really well.
Yeah.
Because they're two different ways of thinking about the literature, and I wanted to have both. So, but... Sacramento is in some ways like Southern California, very dry, gold country hills, all of that sort of beauty, certainly warmer, has a river. So, but after Sacramento, I went to San Francisco to do my master's degree. I didn't know I was going to do a master's degree. That just seemed to be the next thing. So it was a default move.
Okay.
And probably at the time, not necessary, but I just kind of didn't know what to do next moment. And that was available.
Right.
So I did a master's degree at San Francisco State in English literature, because you can only choose one thing once you get to graduate school. And I also met my husband in San Francisco. He quite literally rode into my life on a motorcycle.
Nice.
It was good. It's a good way.
Who could say no?
I know, really. I'm like, okay, that, you know, nice, well played, well played, you know. So, and I was at San Francisco State at a really exciting time to be in San Francisco. Right. So it was pretty great, I have to say. And among the cities that I love, San Francisco remains, mm-hmm. you know, one of the top of the list. When my husband and I talk about, occasionally we kick around, oh, well, where would we move, you know? And San Francisco is always at the top of the short list. Mm-hmm. Although now, because I don't have Silicon Valley wages, you know, I think most people would have to think twice about that impulse. But yeah. We were there at a great time. Let me just put it that way.
Yeah.
We were there in the early 70s, which is my husband was there from 1969 on, and I was there for the next year. So it was full of energy and vitality, and a wonderful time to be young there, and a wonderful time to see bands that I still love play for free in the park, you know.
Right.
And the first time I saw Janis Joplin in a small crowd, and you know, I never forgot that, things like that. So not to mention things that were at the time illegal.
Of course.
Some of which are still illegal in California, but others of which have achieved a form of legality in California.
Yeah.
So, but it was my first experience with a really big city of that kind. So it didn't bother me that it was misty and cold. I thought that was all very romantic and part of it, you know. And on a sunny day, I still don't know why anyone would live anywhere else when the sun's shining on those Victorians and glinting off the water, you know.
Yeah.
So. But from there, now a married person from that point on, worked for several years in the San Francisco area. Did several different things. My first job after I had my master's degree, just to show you how irrational and unlikely things are,
yes,
was as a manager for what was called Circuit Provision for the Pacific Telephone Company the time. Now, I'm a person at that point, a person in her 20s with a degree in literature. And I still remember my first day at work going in, and there was a thing on the desk, on my desk, called at the time a CRT, a cathode ray tube, translated today into "there's your personal computer on your desk," with which I had no experience. But the phone company was under pressure to hire women, as they should have been. Happy to say, mm-hmm. no one will have to infer my politics on this. I'm just explicit about it. And they wanted to, because they were not entirely happy with the way managers, their mid-level managers, were handling people. At that time, many of their mid-level managers had come up through the ranks, and which meant they had started as installers and that kind of thing. And while they were, many of them were bright and, you know, nice and fun human beings, were not perhaps ideally suited for managing and motivating other human beings. So the theory on the part of the phone company was, well, let's hire some people straight in to the management level rather than having them start at lower level jobs, and hire them for their skills with human beings and see how that works out for us. Mm-hmm. So they called this, I'm sorry, I have to giggle because businesses like acronyms so much, they called this the MAP program,
okay.
which was the Management Achievement Program. And the deal was that anyone on the program would be hired for the period of a year. And at the end of that year, you would either be promoted because you had succeeded, kind of trial by fire job, or you would be let go. Mm-hmm. And so they were calling it their sink or swim program. Mm-hmm. Since this was my first kind of really serious job, apart from I had previously, you know, waited tables and worked in a department store and things like that, mm-hmm. this is the first very serious one. It was a bit of a shock and a huge adjustment. And I started out supervising 35 people, and the job of circuit provision was, in fact, to determine which circuits literally were available for usage as people needed more and more of them, as people needed more telephones. And this mm-hmm. is before the era of today, when you have to manage all the other kinds of circuitry
right.
for people. So, but... So why they thought that a kid with a degree in literature was the right move there remains beyond me, but it was a terrific learning experience, really, really hard in a couple of ways. Hard intellectually. One of my first assignments, for example, was to design a new training program for my 35 people I was supervising. And I thought, you want me to design a computer? You know, you're asking to design a computer training program. But I did. So that was, you know, I've always been good at homework.
I would have went to their office and been like, did you get the right resume?
I know.
Really, like, this is my resume.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. But I think, you know, and this is the thing. This is what they mean about a sink or swim program. Here are the assignments, and they come at you, and you either figure out how to do it uh-huh. or you don't. And that was so instructive for me as a, you know, as a person at that stage in her life and in her working life to say, oh, I don't know an awful lot about this, but boy, do I know how to do homework, and I know how to do research. I know those skills inside and out,
yeah.
you know. And so that worked out fine. I worked in a massive basement with, I missed windows, I have to say, at the time. For your listeners, actual physical windows, not computer windows.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's a good distinction. I was seeing what you were seeing, but yeah. Well, Windows wasn't even a thing then,
no,
right? Do you know what the name of the code was that back then?
Didn't exist. No, I don't remember.
Okay.
No, I've managed to black out parts of this experience, you know. But another thing that occurred while I was in that job was that I was asked by my supervisor to translate what had been a 3-day computer run, I'll explain in a minute, into a report that could be given to Pacific Telephone's vice president. So in those days, a computer, apart from my little cathode ray tubes that we had on our desks, the whole basement of our building in downtown San Francisco was floor-to-ceiling tape computers. Mm. You ran the tapes. And it was information about where circuits were and what had been disconnected and which ones had gone missing, which mm-hmm. I just love the idea that a circuit which doesn't exist in physical form anyway can also go missing. Mm. So it's like, okay. And it's a very complex thing, and they would do it about every 6 months to, you know. And so what I got on my desk one day with this request from my supervisor was a stack of pages of numbers with a few comments interspersed that was probably 2 or 3 inches thick, you know, asking if I would translate that into a statement of X, Y, and Z of certain comments. And here again, it was really instructive. Mm-hmm. Because I hadn't had to focus on interpreting numbers that way. Mm. On the other hand, I learned that my skills as a literary scholar, as a person who knows how to transact with texts, was transferable. And mm. this text, as long as I didn't let myself get sort of fall into the deep end of insecurity with, it's all numbers. Mm-hmm. I just remind myself, this is a text. This is speaking a language. I know what to do about those. I know how to interpret them. I know how to think about them. And what I don't know, I know how to learn, which I think is one of the great benefits of an education in the humanities, is that learning to learn thing. So I did this report over the next couple of weeks and submitted it. And about a week later, after it had been due, I received a personal letter from the president and vice president, both of them together, complimenting me on the excellence of the report. And I thought, number one, I like this. And I got thinking about it, well, sure, because we all like to be acknowledged, you know, and it was a very nice letter, just identifying a few things about it and saying that they were happy that they would be able to circulate it more widely in the firm and that kind of thing. And this can seem very isolated to people, but for somebody in her first professional job, especially the kind of professional job, it was a nice boost. It was also instructive. I mean, it reinforced my sense that maybe I was going to be able to do something with my life.
Yeah.
You know? But it also, that job also taught me important things about me. I did not like spending so much time each day that was not focused on ideas.
Mm.
And I think that's a very big adjustment for people who have gone to college in something like literature.
Yeah.
Where so much of our discourse is not only about what does the text say, but what does it mean?
Mm-hmm.
What are the implications? What are the possibilities? What might this mean, even if we're not sure?
Right.
And I found after my year in this program that I didn't feel like that was going to be an appropriate fit for my life.
Right.
Another side of it was very flattering because they did want me to stay. And so I had apparently swum well enough in their sink or swim program for after my first year. But I didn't stay. And a couple of things. After that, I went to work at Berlitz teaching English because, remember, I was in San Francisco.
Okay.
There was a very high density at that time of Japanese businessmen
who
needed to improve their skills with the English language at a very rapid pace. So the Japanese businesses would fund individual work in languages. And I have to say, that was also a lot of fun. Because we would go to the person's home, or sometimes meet at Berlitz, but sometimes in the homes, and hold conversations, and they would have to tell me about their jobs or their life in Japan or their families in English, and I would work with them in that way. Because Berlitz is a total immersion program, so it's all conducted in the language you're learning. So I did that for about a year. And I liked it, but it was a little too random for me, and it wasn't a steady enough paycheck at the time and those kinds of things.
Yeah,
so there wasn't enough of it. It really was a kind of part-time job.
Okay.
So while I was still at Berlitz, I applied for a job as a library assistant, since I didn't have a degree as a librarian, with the city of Daly City, which is one of the suburbs immediately adjacent to San Francisco on the south side. And I got that job. And I did that job for about 4 or 5 years, and I loved it. I loved it. I got to work with people and help them find things and talk to them about books. I also got to sometimes just dig around in the basement of this big old building and put the books in order and, you know, thumb through them while I was there. And it just became clearer and clearer to me what a bookish person I was, you know. And so one day, my husband, I should mention during this time because it's fun, also went through several jobs, but the one he had the longest was he worked for the San Francisco Municipal Railway, meaning he was a muni driver. So he drove originally the electric buses with the overheads, and he also drove the trolleys. And then during our last time there, he was a cable car driver, which is a whole series of separate stories because people think they're going to take a cable car driver home as a souvenir.
Oh.
Let me just put it that way.
Wow.
Yeah. So
it's as sexy as a motorcycle driver. I didn't realize. Wow.
It's all about transportation. Modes of transit, you know. But we were sitting in our flat in San Francisco one day, We were renting up one of those great old Victorian flats, you know, for a totally reasonable price, I'm sure, in those days. And we got chatting about what we were doing, and, you know, I was just saying, I was probably just being cranky about stuff at my library job, and he didn't love everything about his job. And so I was like, meh, 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 kind of moment. And then he said, well, I can see this clearly. I can see us in the kitchen to our flat, which had blue and white checked gingham curtains that I had made, and an old stove that I was in love with, a Wedgwood stove from probably the 1920s. Wow. Yeah, it was beautiful, old stove, things like that. You can see the scene, and we were talking, and he said, well, okay, if you could do anything, what would you do? And I said, my usual temperament, oh, no, it's fine. You know, I like where I work, and I like being about books, and love San Francisco. And we had season tickets to the theater every year, and so that fed my theater side. Yeah. And, you know, we could take bike rides to Napa and things. And I said, no, you know, it's good, blah, 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 blah. And he said, no, no, no. And I said, you know, we have a great flat, and we have to think about that. He says, no, no, no. He says, let's play Let's Pretend. Okay. So drop all the concerns about, you know, rent or this or that, and just, you're just playing Let's Pretend. If you could do anything, what would you do? And what surprised me is that I had a response almost without pause. And I said, oh, I guess I'd go back to graduate school and get a PhD in some kind of literature, maybe Shakespeare or Chaucer. And without a pause, he said, then that's what we'll do. Which is the moment when you say to yourself, holy crap, what have I just said? You just go, oh no.
Yeah.
But that's what we did.
Yeah. I still can't, I'm still in that phase of like, what am I going to do? But as we were talking about earlier, most of my choices had to be out of survival. Like, just I needed to have some kind of income. But I do like that you brought up the things that you did after master's, because I imagine that some students are going to hear this podcast in the future, you know. And there is that question, like, what do you do after a master's? What do you do after a PhD? Because, you know, sometimes you walk away from it and you're like, wait, what? And I definitely relate to, you know, I've studied electronics since, and I've actually thought about doing library studies, but I'm like, right now with cost of education, it's kind of like, can I afford to pursue this?
Especially if you're not in the current moment, if you're not certain it's going to lead to employment. I mean, I had the liberty of some latitude there,
right?
Because I did feel confident. One thing after doing my MA and then having those different jobs, I didn't realize I had confidence in it, but what it taught me was that I can find work.
Yeah.
And that was a really useful period of time, you know, that you could find work. And I think that actually helped me when I did go into the PhD, because jobs are not guaranteed at the end of a PhD, and it's a huge financial investment and a huge investment of your time.
Right.
You know? So I actually like better the idea that people don't go straight through. I was between school things about 7 years, and I suppose the other thing I would add is whatever you do in between, you know, that degree and the time you land in the spot you think is the one, is your forever spot,
right.
You know? I don't think any of it's ever wasted, ever. I don't think a minute of those jobs was wasted, because I was learning things not only about the jobs, and I think that was in some ways the less important, but I was learning a lot about me, and I was working with people that I would never have met if I were sitting at home in a corner and needing to learn to navigate that and benefiting from it. I mean, the world got bigger for me. I always have in me that I was a kid from Woonsocket, Rhode Island, which is one of the smallest state. It is the smallest state and one of the smallest cities. So that's always a part of myself. As is this person now who has done these other things. But there's a there's a process of navigating that, and I always feel like those interim jobs were just feeding that process, which isn't to say, you know, it's not pleasant when you're close to the end of the budget. At the,
yeah.
You know, it's really, it's not pleasant. But even my husband and I had some times when we were living very close to the edge of things. Even the, my first year of graduate school was that way. And I have said now, in these later years, I've been able to say, I also think it's good that we know how to be poor together.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, it's very, it's a very useful skill. I don't mean people should seek it.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
It is nicer not to have to. But it's useful for a couple at a certain point in life to say, no, we know how to do that.
Yes.
You know. And I think that was a part also of those interim years where it's like, it's okay, because I'm still living my life. I'm still present in my life. This is what it is.
Yeah.
And I'm getting the privilege of learning what's going to fit me and what isn't.
Yeah. I still... When I first met my husband, he just got out of graduate school, and he's an immigrant, and so he, his family would send him maybe $300 a month. He had to make that stretch. And I still remember clipping coupons from Subway sandwiches and splitting a foot-long sandwich between us to make sure that we had a meal between, and buying like canned foods for under a dollar. And it's funny because now we're so blessed, is that, like, we don't worry about things. But when people look at my life now, they're like, oh, you know, you know this and that. And it's like, no, I remember that. And if I had to go back to that, I tell them that even now when he has a bad day at work. I'm like, I'll live under a bridge with you with a tarp and a grocery cart. We can do it. So, yeah, it's a very powerful memory that I relate to.
It's a power you have within your own life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it is. It's a kind of power that you're lucky if you get the chance to have it in some way. And again, I am not advocating being poor, or, you know, but or those interim moments between, you know, with a degree. But it does give you that feeling that you have you don't just think or wonder if you have a capacity. You know you have a capacity to manage your life in a way that's in line with something like your values, something like your hopes,
yeah.
You know? And that's hard because studies have always shown that there is a point of income,
yeah,
above which people gain a kind of liberty to worry about other kinds of things,
yeah.
But below which the need simply to get that income has to be the primary drive.
Right.
And that's, I think, one of the significant issues for me of poverty, and there are many, but that for me is one of them, which is it positions too many people, mm-hmm. I feel like, in the wealthiest country on the planet where
Absolutely.
I live, you know, that kind of poverty positions people so they don't have certain liberties,
mm-hmm.
you know. And some of those liberties I can take for granted, and I'm deeply grateful for that. But, you know, yes, we can all go to the movies. Yes, we can
yes.
all. I can go to Disneyland, which, as we know, costs a fortune and shouldn't. But
yeah.
that kind of thing. So, I mean, I think that poverty level question is, as a social question,
yeah.
is troublesome in so many ways. I mean, the obvious way, which is just survival.
Yeah.
But beyond that, there is a kind of way you get the privilege of relating to your entire life that is not available to you if the thing you have to be thinking of morning to night is food and shelter.
Yeah. Yeah. The yeah. Maslow hierarchy of need.
Right. Yeah.
So you wanted to mention another thing about the back when you worked in the telecom.
Yes. So one of the, something I did when I left that job was I sued the phone company for job discrimination.
Hmm.
So this is also part of an interesting moment in a person's life. I was raised to be a nice girl. I was raised that nice girls don't make waves. And I think even to this day, I'm still a little surprised that I am the person who did this.
Hmm.
But I did feel that during my time at the phone company, I had been treated in a way different from the male colleagues. Mm-hmm. And I should mention, for example, that there was one other woman brought in on this program and all of the other ones were men. And that I was the, in my unit, I was the only female supervisor and there were four men supervising about, we all had probably about 160 people total in that. So you could see that there was already a pattern in place at the phone company, and they were trying to begin to address it, admittedly. But there were things that would occur periodically or probably routinely that would be things like my boss asking me, my daughter's about your age, and she's staying at home raising children. You know, when do you plan to do that?
Mm.
Or things like the other supervisors always, every day, going out to lunch with each other and never once including me in that.
Mm-hmm.
And they, again, this is a group that were all males and I was the only female. And so it was a kind of a closed party. It's a very isolating experience. There were just odd things like that. And then at the end of the year, when I had succeeded and I had all the stuff in writing about that, we talked about promoting me. They wanted to promote me in an area that I was not interested in going.
Hmm.
And there was a little bit of finagling going on there. So the main thing about it, the thing that I want to say to people, especially women in this case, is that what I started to feel was depressed about the job. And I was doing well at it, much to my surprise, as I've suggested, but I was also feeling emotionally some depression. And I'm not temperamentally, I do get down like normal people do, but I'm not routinely. So, and so finally, you know, thought about it and also talked it over with my spouse and realized that it's this constant sense of being undermined that really wears you down, and that it was happening to me on the basis of my being the woman,
mm-hmm.
or as several of them said, the girl.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really like water dripping onto a rock. I mean, it just drips and drips and drips.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that most of the people that did or said things were intentionally sexist and intentionally discriminatory. I think they were people raised in a certain mindset, in a certain situation. And now, plunk, here comes this woman, kind of, what do we do with her? However, as the person at the receiving end of that, it can be very problematic. So I want to add that footnote. So ultimately, there was and is a statewide organization called the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC. And I went and spoke with a counselor there and filled out a form, a document. She talked about my circumstances and what kinds of things had been said and when they'd been said and compared salaries, mine with other people's and so on. And I filed a complaint. I filed a legal complaint.
Hmm.
And one of my favorite things about that document to this day, and I don't have it, but to this day is it said I, Karen Cunningham, and then it had a series of things about treatment and about inequitable salary treatment and things like that, things that have been said, et cetera. And then I'm claiming job discrimination on the basis of sex, which is the thing. And then the next line, the line right above your signature, it says, I am a woman.
Hmm.
And then your name goes under that.
Hmm.
So it's the phrase, I'm a woman, is serving as the explanatory phrase. These things are inappropriate because they're discriminatory against me as a woman. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And then you sign your name. And I thought, I'm a kid in my 20s. And now I have a document that proves that I just crossed some adulthood threshold here, yeah. You know. So it's a funny process because people who hadn't complained then become angry. They don't become angry. They feel you have invalidated them in some way. And so they react sometimes not as your friend any longer,
right.
I guess that. So there are there are consequences for this decision, for decisions like this that go beyond, you know, what most people are aware of. But the long-term result was that there was a finding, what was called a consent decree, whereas the phone company admits no culpability. However, I received a small check because apparently I had been inappropriately, my salary had been inappropriately different from others. The person who supervised me, who I had documented the kinds of things he had said and done, was removed from supervising.
Oh.
Yeah. Which is what should have happened.
Yeah.
And the other women in supervising positions all received bonuses and raises because it turned out that none of them had been being paid equally either. So those were the results of my little piece of paper thing. And I think about that sometimes because I don't know if I would find it in myself to do it again. Huh. So I'm kind of glad I found it then, you know.
Yeah. Well, something that came up with, I guess you'd call her a colleague that we had here, Professor Little. She's writing now, and we spoke with her two episodes ago, and I brought up all the recent things with women's right and the sexual allegations. And one thing that came up in an interview in a French news source was an older woman who kind of felt like, you know, nothing's going to change. That, you know, right now we have a lot of men that are, you know, a lot of allegations are coming out. Most of them are probably true. Most of them are institutional, that they've been there forever. And so I could see why people would be like, other people have probably blown the whistle and have not had any success or been pushed back to the point where I think I heard with the Weinstein issue that some girls had, you know, just quit acting altogether. Because when they got into that moment where Weinstein assaulted them, you know, basically raped them, regardless of however he did, whatever he did, that it was just so unsettling. But you, at that time, I guess the thing that comes up is when you're in your 20s, you're very optimistic.
Yeah.
And right now, obviously, there's a lot of women very optimistic, but they're more organized. And
right.
How do you see that now? Do you think that things are going to change, I guess, is the question.
I don't know.
Well, you're not the authority. Let's pull out the crystal ball, the palantir, and
I'm not sure I've ever been a very good prognosticator about these things. I think that it is to the good that there seems to have reached, you know, we got to some kind of critical mass where more women who had not spoken out, whatever their reasons, did feel that they could speak out or found it within themselves in that context to speak out and say, these kinds of things happened and it's not okay with me because I get to say what happens to my body or in front of it.
You
know? You know? Yeah, as the case may be.
Every now and then somebody gets creative, I guess.
Well, I'm still a little baffled by some of that personally, but, you know,
right.
Like, okay. As was my husband walking around going, why is that fun? And
I think that
you're one of the boys. You have to answer that because I don't know.
I think that that's part that, the part that's getting that's missing in that particular dialogue with Weinstein is like, oh, women are, because I think that the society's already been, there's a circuit breaker, if you will, that's already been built in about how the women are whatever, like how to minimize what they're coming up with. But a lot of men are looking at Weinstein the same way. They're like, what? Like, how? Who? Why? Why? For like, what, 20, 30 years? So, I mean, we don't know the answers.
Well, I no, but I, I'm happy that we're equally baffled.
Yes.
I mean, you know, because it does seem just odd to me. I will say that there is a part of me that wishes some of these women, when they became bulletproof, because some of them did. Some of them became very wealthy. Mm-hmm. Some of them became secure in their careers. Some of them became in a position where they could have said something. Mm-hmm. I wish they had found what it took to do that earlier, because they have to live with knowing that they might have started opening things up and, you know, prevented some other young women from needless exposure, so to speak.
Yes.
You know, so, and maybe that's partly generational, although I think I'm the age of some of the people who might have said something. So, I do find that part of it troubling, and it's not specific in this case to the Weinstein thing, nor I have to say even to sexual harassment or misconduct or those kinds of things in general. It's something that troubles me and that I wonder about in our public in an individual's relationship to public obligations and responsibilities. When something is amiss and something happens to you that you might speak out about, the way I was raised, you speak out because you have an obligation to preventing it from being perpetrated on others. And I was also raised that for anything you do, there will be consequences.
Right.
Which is the other side that I find a little curious, is the assumption that there shouldn't be consequences.
Right.
Even if you're on the side of right. Mm-hmm. And again, part of this is age and generation, but, you know, in the marches that I went to, there were and have been in, there have always been consequences. Mm-hmm. The documents I have signed and put my name to, there have been consequences.
Yes.
There has been blackballing in an industry. There has been loss of friends. There have been all of that, none of which are a reason not to have done it.
Right.
You know, and so... So I get a little concerned. This is not about the Weinstein thing directly, but a little concerned when I seem to be hearing the idea that, you know, I would stand up for this or I would stand up for that, but I might lose something. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what...
Yeah.
You know, we didn't hear the suffragettes who said women need the vote saying, well, but I might lose something.
Right.
They did.
Yeah.
You know? But we also didn't hear Martin Luther King say, I'm not going to do this because I might lose something.
Right.
You just do it.
Yeah.
You know, knowing there will be consequences. So I'm a little concerned about how much the there shouldn't be consequences theme seems to be a part of some wider cultural thinking now, because that's paralyzing.
Yeah.
That prevents good people from speaking out.
I mean, you and I feel like, as you gave your history, grew up in a similar America, though. Maybe it's like a West Coast thing that doesn't exist or the rest of the country anymore. But yeah, there is a structure that there is consequences if you go outside of that structure. But if you see an injustice, that you have to make that sacrifice. Or you know, my family grew up, you know, in a lot of unions. So, you know, you organize. You even with something that's going on with my neighbor right now, it's very obvious to me that if everyone's being afflicted by one person, you create a coalition, you create an agreement and understand there's a problem. We're all being disrupted by this and we need to stand up for this. So I agree with you on kind of this shift that is kind of like, why didn't anyone say anything?
Yeah. And again, I mean, it's complicated because there is the emotion, there is the psychology, there is the, gosh, I'll never work in this industry. Although, some people decided they wouldn't work in that industry.
Yes.
And they have something important intact, which is their sense of integrity.
Yeah.
Should they have had to make that decision? Absolutely not. No. Of course not. But they made that decision, and I hope should recognize what, you know, said nice, strong spines they have for making those decisions. So it's really only the people who at some point became less vulnerable to the manipulation going on. It's always a little sad when those people don't, you know, say, and the first thing I'm going to do when I have this much in the bank, whatever it is for them, is this, and then they don't. you know, and that's that whole issue of consequences. Yeah.
Well, hopefully anyone that's listening to this and kind of is entering their career, that they have this in mind, that, you know, they have those choices to make. Because I'm sure that there's still going to be doors to be pushed to open and Absolutely. Glass ceilings to break. Well, let's steer maybe more back towards, you know, there's a lot of things that I don't know about you professionally. And I know that you're... research focus has been Shakespeare and law, or at least I see that come up a lot. So what has been some of the blissful aspects of that part of your career? And I know you have lots of lectures and all that. So what continues to bring joy to you about that, those aspects of research?
Well, part of this comes from no doubt being a Libra and, again, not being able to decide between A and B, and also being attached to an abstract idea of justice since birth. There, I will find a way to have justice. But when I went back to graduate school, you know, my leaning was towards the PhD in literature, which is what I ultimately did. But I also had been drawn to law school. So after some years of teaching, I was able through my research, spend a lot of time reading law books. So you see, there's a way to manage it so I get the best of both of those things. But I actually started on the law issue not based on law. I started because I was interested in violence.
Oh.
I was interested in violence in Renaissance drama and in trying to understand, just trying to think about the appeal of very graphic, sensationalist violence in plays like Christopher Marlowe's in general, things like Tamburlaine, where you cut people up and stomp on them and everything on the stage. And also something like Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus, which is one of the most sensationalistic, violent plays ever done. From the academic side, we were always taught that the violence, most violence, wasn't staged, that it was a sign of an immature playwright, you know, and just too sensationalistic, or it's meant to be done off stage. But then in Titus Andronicus, it's so specific, it's so clear from the text that it's happening on stage that you have to say, what is wrong, Shakespeare?
Right.
You know? So I wanted to understand about violence, so I started thinking, well, what are the forms of public entertainment historically that used violence? Okay, so this was an interesting year or two of research, and so because I ended up just reading way more than is healthy for a person about the kinds of aesthetic violence that people can do to each other, including back in Rome, where in order to entertain an emperor, but also an assembled crowd, you could build a large copper or brass bull with the nostrils open or the mouth open.
Yeah.
And then they would put a person in it whom they wished to torture.
Yeah.
And then they would build a fire under it. And as the brass or copper heated, the person inside, who was, of course, burning to death, would scream, and it would sound like the bull was screaming, making bull noises, whatever those might be.
There's
and
a cinematic version of that in the movie Immortals.
Oh,
and so I'm like reliving, because they did a very good, scary, bad job of,
Well, it is historically accurate.
Yeah.
So and it, you know, and so things like that, where you, you know, that's what you do when you want to understand violence in the Renaissance, you look at that. But among the other things I ended up looking at was public executions. And in Shakespeare's day, public executions were very theatrical. They were staged for audiences. You could buy a seat. Some people, we have records of people ordering their pub breakfast while someone was being, you know, having their head cut off in the area, that kind of thing. So while on the one hand, the idea of a public execution is associated with the idea of a deterrent, you know, this will prevent others from imitating the illegal action. On the other hand, it was clear to those ordering executions and benefiting from them that there was a kind of public pleasure in them. So that's what got me working on the violence, which ended up turning into some writing about Marlowe, and the relationship between theater that is theatrical staging violence, mm-hmm. and political staging of violence in executions, because they're very formalized. Mm-hmm. They, you don't just cut somebody up. I mean, the long process of the death where you, for something like treason, very specific script is followed.
Oh.
So, yeah, so you drag the person on a hurdle, which is like a cot, from the prison to the site at which they're going to be executed down the street so that people can throw stones or fruit or anything at them. And sometimes you put their head at the lower end of the cot, so it's bouncing on the cobblestones, right?
Yeah.
So you start there. So they're dragged on a hurdle. And then when they get there, they are hanged until half dead. And it's very specific, half dead, not. So the execution is not to be hanged, you're half dead. Then you're taken down and you are quartered. Okay, so your your two legs and two arms are pulled apart until all your joints are dislocated. And you are disemboweled. Okay. All of those things. And you get your head cut off. It's a long, but listen to how scripted it is, right? And all these things have meaning and significance, you know, and they, in their long history, many of them are associated with rituals of the sacred and things like that.
The quartering I've heard before been associated with the cult of Dionysus, which was Greek. So this has carried on for a very long time. I didn't realize that even in Renaissance, that they were still doing this.
They were big at quartering in the Renaissance.
Wow.
Yeah, no, it's a long history.
We hear about the Spanish Inquisition, and like I think those are probably the most culturally pop version of like, oh, okay, yeah, they did this. It was terrible, but it was like a norm. At least the other stuff was a norm in England.
Yes, this was, and that the script I gave you was the norm for treason if you were found to be a traitor. And so, if you're looking at Shakespeare's lifetime, there are more treason laws and more treason executions during his lifetime than any time before or since in English history.
Mm-hmm.
So these were, this was just a recurring thing. But
and to catch other people that maybe aren't quite as familiar with Shakespeare's time, there was still a lot of Protestant versus Catholic. And some of the treason was around that.
Yes,
right?
A great deal of the treason was manufactured from that dispute. Yes, because in Shakespeare's day, you have a queen on the throne who is managing a country that has become officially Protestant, officially Anglican in the modern day when it gets that name. You know,
which is always a fun story of how England became Anglican.
I always say that it was one afternoon in about 1535 when Henry VIII said, let's not be Catholic anymore. Okay, we're Protestant now. Mm. And that's basically what happened. So and that was over. But obviously many people still in their hearts were drawn toward Catholicism. So there was a feeling that Catholics in England might attempt harm to Elizabeth, and this ran throughout most of Shakespeare's lifetime, that she would be kidnapped and they could put a Catholic on the throne, that she would be assassinated, and so on. A good deal of that was probably manufactured, but there certainly was a lot of sentiment about it. But it was the violence, right? The staging of violence and having to come to terms with it as a crowd pleaser that pushed me towards law.
Okay.
Because my next question, after I had worked on that for a while and on the executions, was, okay, so what kind of a narrative does it take to justify killing someone legally, legitimately?
Hmm.
And that turned me to, these are all, to studying that, to doing the research. What are the ways that we can bring a person to death legally?
Mm-hmm.
Not just a duel or a romantic fight or those kinds of things, but what's the path of the law towards this moment?
I think this is a good time to bring up, what do you feel with your research, literature kind of captures a moment artistically? And so Shakespeare seeing something, and you know, just like now we create films that kind of bring a social injustice to, you know, to the public, or even sometimes it looks like I'm being too abstract, but like the movie The Help reminds us of this moment, or you brought up Martin Luther King Jr. and there was that great film Selma that kind of reminds us like this was America at a certain time. So with Shakespeare and law, what do you think with any other literature when you look into these particular subjects? Because someone might say, well, why didn't you just study law in Renaissance time? And you've already explained that, but maybe someone else who's maybe trying to decide their own path, you know, what does studying arts tell us about a culture that used to exist is, I guess, the larger question here.
Well, I said earlier, I couldn't decide between literature, a literature degree, and a theater degree at one point. Theater is the great reminder because it embodies things. Mm-hmm. But that, for me, is one of the key things about thinking about literature. Shakespeare and law, when I think about Shakespeare and law, Shakespeare is thinking about the law. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have to be an administrator. He doesn't have to be a prosecutor nor a defender, the equivalents of those in the Renaissance. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have an official commitment to the government one way, you know, either on the government side or officially a resister to the government. Mm-hmm. None of that. What he can do is explore the kind of human motivations, mm-hmm. And decisions and consequences, again, of various ways of thinking about the law. So what I get from the literary side, mm-hmm. is, and I think this about literature in general, and certainly about Shakespeare, is I get to look at a person, an artist, mm-hmm. thinking about an issue, mm-hmm. thinking about something that interests him, and some of those interest me. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Yeah.
So I was just finishing up. I am just giving a final later this week on my Shakespeare and Law class, and I'm just saying that. I said, you know, part of it is how we think about law. This is one of the most interesting things to me that I've learned from some of this. And I want to refer you to Clifford Geertz's book called Local Knowledge.
Okay.
And I want not to forget, it's Geertz, first name Clifford, called Local Knowledge. It's an anthropology book and it's been out for many decades, but very influential on a lot of people in academia in terms of how to think about cultures. Mm-hmm. He's an anthropologist, but he's a cultural anthropologist, and it's a helpful book. But he talks about law at one point, and I didn't bring the quotation, so I will get it wrong, but I will approximate it, which is, he says that if what we think law is a collection of rules and statutes and edicts to be followed, then we fail to understand what it is. Mm-hmm. That law is, in fact, a created way, right, of imagining the real. Mm. So we're back to Shakespeare.
Right.
Law, yeah. You know, which is that working on Shakespeare and law has given me the opportunity to think about law not as something like thou shalt not kill, even
right.
biblical law, but what does it mean in this, how does it even happen in this kind of a community, mm-hmm. with these kinds of characters, with these kinds of motives and personalities? How does it even happen that there is murder?
Right.
Right. And then what's the appropriate response to it?
Right.
And why would you choose that response and not this one? What are some of the possible responses that a single person might not figure out?
Mm-hmm.
That's what Shakespeare lets me think about, that mm-hmm. a law book that says, you know, thou shalt not kill, doesn't let me think about.
Right.
So it really works for me both ways. It has amazed me when I started wanting to think about law in Shakespeare.
Okay.
That it's everywhere in every play. And my students have been persuaded, I think, this quarter, about that. Like, I had no idea, you know.
Yeah.
And of course they wouldn't, because we don't bring the law background. Students don't bring the background in 16th century law to reading it. So they're not seeing it, and they need a guide, right? And I'm the guide on that particular project. So it's working with Shakespeare has also given me the extra benefit of thinking about law differently. So when I am talking to lawyers and other people or looking at a legal case in the newspaper that I might want to write a letter about or something like that or follow up with, I have the benefit of having thought about it through the lens of someone thinking about it in very human terms.
Right. Yeah, that's something that I grew up in a very fundamentalist church, and so a similar problem with the law and the Bible. And then later on, becoming an English major and being able to apparently my whole life was born to be an English major in that sense, because I just studied words over and over again and come with thousands of interpretations, but none of them are grounded culturally, historically. And so, you know, erotic. I know when you're talking for a while, you get.
I have unfortunately developed asthma in the last couple of years, and the fires have not helped.
Same. But yeah, the literal and being it surrounded with your research, being surrounded by what's happening historically, because I'm sure a lot of law students don't, like you're saying, they don't get maybe the cultural stuff that happened. And people don't think about, like, why did this law that happened 200... The Constitution would be a great example. I've heard that, you know, the debate between the different justices and their... I don't remember the exact name for the different theories, the schism. But obviously some are trying to interpret what the forefathers meant versus, I think, like... You know, Ruth Ginsburg or whatever, she's much more like, you know, it's a living text now. Like, we have to apply it now, because if we do what they did 200 years ago, it was a completely different world. So I know you've talked it. I saw in your CV you've talked at, you know, law schools and such. So that's great. Any specific conversations that have come up that you can recall when you brought this to light?
Not really. Nothing so interesting, I have to say, is that as the Constitution question, the newest Chief Justice, the most recently appointed, they were describing as a textualist. So I think that's the current, you know, one of the current languages for describing someone whose philosophy is that the Constitution is to be read in as limited a fashion as possible, what's on the page, and not extended to other possibilities that don't seem to be explicitly in the text. Mm-hmm. Versus, again, it has many names, the other view that says that we read it with an eye towards what the founders might have intended and its relationship to the modern day when we are applying it, because we aren't applying it in 1776, we're applying it in 2017 kind of thing. So that debate has always been there in terms of that. It's kind of an interesting one to me and to you, you know, as literary people,
because
what's the literal meaning and what does it really mean kind of thing. So we're always thinking in those double terms. Most of my experience with law schools really was when I was talking about treason a lot and working on the violence issue, and then working on the way that evidence works and credibility and the way those are gendered, those kinds of things. So that's been more recently a part of my interest, because I also teach Shakespeare and gender classes, and they're not Shakespeare law and gender, but because of my interest in law, it's fairly easy to see some of the gender issues. It's related to a modern day issue, actually, because in Shakespeare's day, women had very relatively limited relationships to legal authority or autonomy. Mm-hmm. So a single woman could make contracts in her own name and could own things in her own name and so on if she had inherited them from the family and if there were no objections from the family, that kind of thing. But a married woman, when she married, gave up the right to individual contracts, individual ownership of her property. It all transferred to her spouse. You know, in an ideal world, he also took on obligations to provide for the family, protect her, etc. So it is certainly a paternalistic culture, but I don't like the idea that, oh, well, this means that all women were miserable. No, just not a system we would necessarily want to go back to.
Right.
but if a woman, women couldn't bring a case in court, so couldn't sue for things, single women typically needed the permission of a father or brother, and married women needed their husband's permission. So if a husband were physically abusing his spouse, she could not bring it into the secular courts without his permission, which, of course, he did not give.
Right.
They could sometimes get a little bit of assistance in the church courts because the church courts tended to be somewhat more sympathetic to wives. But even there, the church's commitment was to the maintenance of a marriage under all circumstances. But it interested me to begin thinking about gender and credibility, and then I was thinking about it lately because there was a tendency in Shakespeare's day to find believable testimony by men and not believable or less believable testimony by women. And that's in part systemic, built into the structure of a patriarchal system that just thinks in those terms, and then reinforced by the legal structure that was in place. But you can imagine me in the modern day listening to what's going on saying, he's credible, not because what he says is credible, but because he's a male,
right,
and she doesn't have credibility, not because what she says didn't happen, but because she's a female, which is very Renaissance and very, you know, very Shakespearean moment. So I was teaching a play called Measure for Measure recently, which is a very thinky play specifically about law and its administration. And it's about the kind of human being you want in charge of your laws, making your legal decisions, another timely, timely issue. But in this play, the person who is put in charge of administering the law, a figure named Angelo, is very rigid and very letter of the law and very fundamentalist in his approach to it, and also very punitive, you know. And the play suggests wants to make his reputation by showing he's a kind of, in the modern way, law and order man. So he sentences to death a young man who has impregnated his fiance. Typically in the Renaissance, that young man would not be sentenced to death. They would be told they have to go ahead and get married, and then that would solve everything. But this guy wants to be letter of the law, and the letter of the law allows him to execute this man. So there's a young woman, the condemned man's sister, Isabella, and she goes to plead for her brother's life. And she does that once, and the next time she goes back to plead again with Angelo for her brother's life, he has been so swept away by her beauty, by her speech, right, that he wants to have sex with her. So what he says is, the deal he offers her is, I'll free your brother. I'll save your brother's life if you will give me your body. I know. I'm just teaching this 2 weeks ago. And my students are rolling their eyes like, oh my gosh, how did Shakespeare know? Like,
Or thinking you're making this up.
Yeah,
you're
like, really. So that's what happens. And he's going to save her brother if she'll have sex with him, and that's the thing. And she refuses because she, at that time, wants to be a nun, which is not what she does.
Yeah.
She marries the hero. But at the end of their second scene together, she says to him, you know, no, I won't do as you ask, and now I see you for what you are, you know, which is a malicious and evil and self-concerned person. You know, you care only about yourself. And I will, she says, I will proclaim you, meaning I'm going to go public. To proclaim is not just, you know, I'm going to tell someone. To proclaim means you're going to go publicly in the streets and say, this is what this man did. I went to speak with him about saving my brother, and instead he proposed sex and promised me this and said this kind of stuff to me, because he does say things to her, you know, in the scenes. I will proclaim thee. And he looks at her and says, who will believe you? And then he points to the fact that he has authority and he has a public role and he's well known and he has all those things she doesn't. And he says, my faults will outweigh your true. So I'm just teaching this in the past couple of weeks, reminding myself that there is a way in which Shakespeare knew everything. It really struck me. My students went, several of my students went, one of them said, does anybody but me think that this play, after they came in with it, that this play is like about today? And I'm just like, welcome to my world.
And that's something good to bring up about, we can get into the one of the, my thesis here today that I shared with you before we came in was, you know, that the current politics with Make America Great Again, patterns that you see that reflect the current concerns, or even the deeper thing, is humanity doom, or is this just another cycle of panic in human history? But because I've studied literature and I love ancient literature and so on, you do start seeing patterns. And Shakespeare plays always come back up, because he kind of was at the cusp of modernity, of a lot of things that continue to be happening now. You know, Coriolanus became very popular, I think, maybe the last 5 years. There was a lot of productions of it. King Lear before that. And I mean, you've obviously, I'm not telling you anything brand new, but just listeners that aren't quite as steeped in the Shakespeare world. So what patterns are you seeing? What is humanity doomed? Or, you know, I've set the base here with, you know, your experience and Shakespeare and law. So I feel that we're not just making things up at this point. What are you seeing?
I do want to say about the Shakespeare in the current moment, which is something to which I alluded earlier, and it's become important to me in my teaching, that I think that writers give us somehow, magically, I have no explanation for that, and I leave that to people who specialize in those areas, give us a world with each work for thinking about social problems. That's one of the things they give us. So that's why, as I was saying earlier, when I work on Shakespeare and law, I didn't crack up such a class merely for my own entertainment. This is the way academics can be subversive. We can find, we all find our own moments of subversion, or what would count as subversion. And for me to be able to be in a classroom working on Shakespeare, because that's always considered a legitimate text to work on. That's one of the biases in literary tradition, you know. There's no particular rational reason for it, but there is a historical reason for it. What gets said in that play has a kind of legitimacy that then can be understood in relationship to your modern moment, your own contemporary moment, okay? That might not have legitimacy if it didn't have Shakespeare's name behind it. It's an interesting phenomenon, but that's part of how it works,
right?
Okay? So I don't even know where that started. But I think in terms of patterns, I think that I don't think of it in terms of patterns. I think that we have a series of recurring issues. Maybe this is what you mean by patterns, but recurring issues that we haven't solved, and by which, you know, by the we, I mean, you know, humans.
Humanity.
Yeah. And that we continue to have to, even if we imagine they're solved at a particular moment, what both our social history and our literary histories tell us is there's not absolute solution in any human endeavor because we just don't, you know, end things in some absolute way. So things recur, and literature provides us with some of the most important crucibles for thinking about those things yet again. And then, you know, 10 years later, again, in maybe different authors, different texts, different this, and then 10 years later, again. But they're never quite the same. So when in 1604, the character Angelo, the evil person in Measure for Measure, says, well, my faults will outweigh your true, for that audience, well, it's revealing a Machiavellian character, a character devoted only to his own desire, but it's in a particular sort of limited context. When we bring that to our current moment, we still have that issue of a person in authority who is devoted to his own desire. So the kind of human issue doesn't go away, and we have the literature that's talked about it, but what we conclude from it wouldn't be exactly the same. It would be more related to our contemporary moment. So the literature actually, quote unquote, changes before our eyes, not because the ink on the page is different, but because we bring our contemporary moment to the literature. But I think in the gender class too, I was going to especially from working on law, but it's true of the gender class, there are simply things that we don't resolve. And that's, for me, been a useful insight in the sense that it makes me feel less discouraged. And that's important, you know, because I think I might have, as I said to you earlier, you know, I could, sometimes things can look a little grim right now in this historical moment in the United States. For a lot of parties. But my literary experience has taught me that we don't resolve things in an absolute way. And I think that's hard. Because ethically and morally and emotionally, I think there are some issues that we want to believe we can solve once and for all. And that's not what I'm seeing. You know, what I'm seeing is change. What I'm seeing in some areas is something that I would call progress. People of a different political persuasion might not consider it progress, but I do. You know, but let me give more neutral questions. In Measure for Measure, an example, the one of the questions is, what should be the character of the person administering the law? And the plot is specific about that. It says, if power change purpose, we'll see what these seamers be. So the, that issue of giving people power. Well, again, in Shakespeare's day, that was a politically explicit philosophical question. And the play gives a certain answer. But that question of what do we want the character of our lawgivers to be is still here. We would answer it differently. We would probably have a more complex answer than the play does in some ways. Because humans aren't automatons. They are themselves complicated and troublesome and constantly changing and all of those things. So I do not think we're doomed. I do think that this is a, in some ways, a low point for certain kinds of things in the United States. But as you and I were saying earlier on, we have survived low points. I do think, I love that quotation about all that is necessary for evil to triumph is for good people to remain silent. So That one I think is important. That's why I think some of the, you know, Me Too stuff is important,
right?
Because it breaks some of the silence. Mm-hmm. I think that from my point of view, there's what I would consider a little too much silence or not enough noise about some other things that I wish there were more noise about. Mm-hmm. And that has to come from, you know, good people choosing not to be silent.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
But I think I think there are things that recur each in their own form. And I don't mean even generationally, just periodically over time.
Right.
And, you know, and I don't see much that we have resolved absolutely. I think a single human being is an amazingly complex entity, and the issues are complex. So if the human beings are complex and the issues are complex, very hard to resolve things in an absolute sense.
Right.
Well, what I have seen, I mean, I've seen progress in my life, and so, you know, I'd like to think I've had some role in some of it just by some really pragmatic things, I believe, which is show up and put your face and name on it.
Yeah, like when I started here, Obama got elected, so there was that optimism. Mm-hmm. But then the Prop 8 thing happened, which no one expected to happen. I protested. After college, I was going canvassing, meeting people door to door. You learn a lot about people when you do that, when you leave your home and you have a face. And I think right now with social media, not to blame everything on social media, but we're not having the face-to-face, and we're not kind of seeing the human being behind our ideas. But I'm probably speaking to the choir. I do want to kind of move more. You have some wonderful artwork here, and I want to get into that now. And I think it's just, you know, the works of art outside of literature, because we don't want to pinhole you into these things, and we know you have other interests. So let's go ahead and see. And I'll go ahead and maybe I'll take note of does it say the name of the artist in the back? Yeah. I'll get names of all these, and I'll put them on my website so people can be a part of them. So go ahead, take us away.
No, I promise to keep this part short. But I love this question, because I'm not asked to frame it the way you asked, which is just, you know, outside of literature.
Right.
What's some art that you love? And you said adore, and I thought, oh, cool, you know.
Yeah.
Not just like, but, you know. Mm-hmm. So among these, a couple of visual things and one sculpting thing. So the visual right now is an American painter, Edward Hopper. Mm-hmm. And a part of this is because it was in the fall in New York, and there was a showing of a lot of his work in one of the museums I was in. So I will say that I can be had easily from museum to museum on art. I really enjoy just looking at it. This is not an area where I'm knowledgeable, and I wouldn't even pretend to be. So
same.
This is an area where I like the experience. Mm-hmm. So the thing about Hopper and the picture that I'm looking at with you is called Railroad Sunset, like that, is that the pictures are so simple. And he didn't name most of them himself because he just wanted people to see them. So the name sometimes came later, like when they were being shown someplace, you know, and someone would say, you need a name for it, and so on. His most famous one is something called Nighthawks. And you will have seen it, and maybe some of your listeners. It's you can tell by the colors. Here's his. I'll show you a nightish picture. No, I don't have any nighttime pictures. Daytime. So Nighthawks is a painting of a diner on a corner in a city, and the block behind it is kind of red brick buildings, nothing going on, and you're kind of coming at the diner, and it's on your right, as though you were walking towards it. Okay. And it's got the only lights on, and the lights are on inside, and there are no people on the exterior streets. There are no other people except the people in the diner.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Okay. and there's a man and a woman in one place, mm-hmm. and then around the corner at the counter in the inside the diner is the single man, and then behind the counter is the obvious counter man in his white hat and his white outfit. Mm-hmm. And everything else, if you look at it, everything else in the painting is still. It's empty. Mm-hmm. So people talked about it, and critics have talked about it, I think, in various ways. But one thing Hopper said about it, he said he wanted it to feel like, people talk about it being about loneliness and isolation. And to me, it's a very Los Angeles moment, although I think it's not. I think it's the Northeast. But to me, it just, so many diners and corners in Los Angeles of maybe the 1950s and 40s or the noir period, you know, it's just, and he called it, I lost track of that, but he called it, he said to him, it was more like the idea of where the viewer is coming from, that someone's coming down the street towards that diner.
Yeah.
And that there would be predators, that was his word, predators outside the diner. So the idea that there are predators in the city somehow, and you're in this illuminated, that's the only light in the picture, this bright, relatively safe place. So I just love how, what I love about it, it's so simple. Hopper, these are realistic paintings, you know, just to talk about them for the listeners there. He likes the Northeast, he likes buildings and cities, but you'll notice no people in that, no people in this, no people in that, no, you know, and then
It was funny because this one that you just handed me early Sunday morning, I was like, it looks like a city in the early Sunday morning. Mm-hmm. Nailed it.
Perfect. See, you could have named that one for him, right?
Yes.
Like that. And the other thing about it is somebody commented that this city block, which has the old-fashioned barber's pole in front, that the barber's pole is standing there sort of for a person, as though there were a person alive in the picture. I thought that was an interesting observation from someone looking at it, because, again, it's an empty street. But I like the serenity of them.
Okay.
I'm a rail fan, so I like to travel by train. And they don't get to do it that often. But and a lot of this came from San Francisco and all the rail transit and my husband's association with it and riding cable cars and things. And so I'm a big fan of it. So Railroad Sunset to me really, because it simply has that one building, that tall building looking out, you know, by the tracks, and then the beautiful sunset as though it were spread out over the ocean. It's spread out over land, but it, you know, could be the Pacific. So, but again, notice the simplicity of the natural picture and the single building, but not people.
Yeah.
I find it really serene.
It also, because this particular painting, 1929, and the one I just mentioned, 1930, was also like an America that wasn't maybe quite as populated. Maybe like a Sunday, everything would shut down on a Sunday.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or, you know, that there wasn't always something happening.
Right.
So yeah, I like that. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I love that. I love the Hopper things. And so then I was also thinking about another painter whom I have just responded to for years, which is Mark Rothko. And I'm interested in my own response to those only in the sense that I don't overanalyze it, but I have loved them. So Rothko paintings, you know, you're nodding knowing the name, and I assume some listeners may and some might not, but the canvas is a collection of, I don't even want to say pattern, although they are, a collection of different colors, and they all tend to run horizontally, so they tend to run left to right, and you might have one shade of orange across the top and then a different shade of orange below that, and then a yellow below that, and then a deep red below that, and the borders among them all are blurred. It's never a perfectly clean line, and Hopper tends to be so clean, and Rothko is so not. So they're all abstract, the Rothko, and he also, he didn't name them, so they get numbered more than anything. I think that's interesting about painters, that a lot of times they don't want to name them. And again, going back to one of the things Rothko had said was, I just want people to look at them for the emotion. Yeah. So he does have an idea of the emotion he hopes observers will have. And I don't know that I ever had one that he wanted.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But I love them. And I get the, for me, I get the same thing I get from looking at the particular Hopper ones, which is there's a serenity factor in them that I find kind of mesmerizing.
No, yeah.
Maybe because I live in Los Angeles and drive on freeways. And so something that is so still,
yeah,
you know, seems very attractive to me in art.
Yeah.
So I do love those.
A friend of mine, we go to lots of museums. Go to museums whenever I'm in a different city. And we have a game. And this goes even before the selfies were a thing, our digital cameras. And, you know, you used to not be able to take pictures in a museum. So it was like a ninja game where we would try to get a picture with the Rothko. And we would, even to this day, she went to Spain this summer and she was like, got it. So, yeah, I mean, we do sit in front of them. It's just a selfie thing. But it's because we love them so much that we kind of are like, oh, I was here. Like, I guess, you know, like you take a picture in front of the Eiffel Tower. To us, that's that moment. So I totally relate to the Rothko thing.
I just think I remember being struck by, again, you know, what art can do. In this case, we're talking visual art. But because they are so simple that you always think, oh, well, I could paint that. And then there are all these people who try to, and they don't have, even if you don't know, if you put the Rothko next to an anonymous and you don't know which is which, you find yourself drawn to one more than the other. They've actually, some people have tried this. So it's just the most curious thing to me, you know, that there's a, there is that spark of genius that figures have and that. And so the Rothkos, they silent as they are, they speak to me.
Yes, same.
But then my other one, I said, well, I don't have to stick only to painters here. So this is my current affection. Well, actually, he was a painter, which is Michelangelo. But it isn't because of things like I finally got to the Sistine Chapel and saw it in person, so that was good, and saw the walls and the frescoes and all of that, and saw the Last Judgment up by the altar and all of how overwhelmingly powerful those things are. However, I also got to Florence and saw the sculpture of the David. Okay. And that has just continued to just wow me because, have you seen it in person?
I have not seen it in person. I've not been to Italy yet.
Okay.
But and it's funny because on the last episode, the last guy, he does mail, and we were talking about how subversive Michelangelo was, that he got the church basically to pay for him to do these things. But the friends that I have that have seen it in person, they're like, it's even more gorgeous. And my friends that have done art, they're like, he kind of, I guess Michelangelo, as we know, was understood the human form and understood the golden ratio. Is that right? But he kind of fudged some of the things about David to make him look even more perfect as a sculpture. So I find that fascinating.
Yes. What is striking in person, I had seen, as with the Sistine Chapel work, you know, I had certainly seen representations on slides and in books and other places, so it's just nice to be in the presence. We all know that kind of thing. And that, it surprised me, the difference about the David. But of course, with sculpture, you're talking about something 3D that exists embodied in your same embodied world, which, you know, the paintings I've talked about don't. They exist in a different way. So that in itself, of course, you know, I should have anticipated would be powerful. But the 12 feet high and the way it's, and this is part of it, the way it's displayed where it is. So you actually come in a hallway, and this is brilliant to me. You come in a hallway, and along the sides are pieces of granite or marble that are partially carved sculptures. So they're, you know, they're big. They're like 2 by 3 and maybe 3 feet tall, and you'll see part of a form in them. And then the artists, in some cases, Michelangelo, abandoned them. So you can see that they're, and remember that comment about, well, you take the granite or the marble, you take the marble and you chip away at it until the form shows you itself, mm-hmm. okay? That you're not creating it, that it's in there and you just have to get the other stuff out of the way. And so it's lined up with these different sculptures that are incomplete, all in the block, but part of the body sticking out. I mean, it's just amazing. And then at the end of that hallway is the David on the pedestal being enormously tall. And that's just, it's just breathtaking. It's breathtaking. Everybody comes through there and just goes, you know. And part of it is the dominance of the size.
Yeah.
You know, it's, and then you actually just, I mean, you are, it like, you know, as I was saying about the paintings, it's mesmerizing. Uh-huh. They even have a horseshoe of seats around the back for you to just sit down and kind of stare with your jaw open.
That's great. That's wonderful.
So the sense that it's on the one hand, the quote, as you said, human form.
Yes.
Certainly an idealized version.
Absolutely.
You know, but that. But the other side of it is that he seems, of course, superhuman. He seems godlike, both in the size of that and in the way it's displayed.
Right.
So you have this sense of the David as a kind of divinity and the way humanity is divine, even though it isn't, kind of thing.
You right.
know? So, but that's my sculpture moment, because that was a relatively recent adventure, and it was just, you know, a jaw-breaking, you know, the kind where your jaw drops, and I love having those moments, you know.
Right.
They're just thrilling. So those are my art things for
okay.
the moment.
Excellent. Well, I have lots of more questions, but we're going on third hour here, which so I will wrap up now then, and thank you for speaking with me today. It was wonderful. I hope you enjoyed it as well. And if you're comfortable, I can come back and we can follow up with some of the questions we missed or anything else that happens to pique your interest in the future. All right. So thank you for being on the show. And I guess that's it.
Thanks for asking me again. And this was a pleasure. It's fun to think about these things. And it's especially fun to think about them with you. So I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Never Meet Your Heroes podcast. Find us at nevermeetyourheroespodcast.com, where you can post comments, ask questions, and interact with artists and listeners. Also, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter and Instagram. And if you're on YouTube, don't forget to comment, like, and subscribe.